I'm Matt Rogan, and this is the Playbook Podcast. Today, we're looking at the importance of being able to flex your style as a leader. The podcast was actually recorded before the Super League announcement in European football, but many of the themes we cover seem particularly prescient and relevant in its aftermath.
From Sports Pro, this is the Playbook Podcast with Matt Rogan.
I'm Matt Rogan, and this is the Playbook Podcast, where leaders from inside and outside sport share pragmatic advice for leading and managing through change. Today, we're looking at the sheer breadth of your responsibilities as CEO, from building a coherent, credible relationship with your local community to a global audience and delivering on those responsibilities. I wanted to look at the duality of that in more detail, and I couldn't think of anybody better to spend time with on that subject than Peter Moore.
With online gaming and the advent of millions of people playing at the same time, games changed as regards the way you interacted with them. And then they became full-on live services. New content every day, every week, new ways to play, all based on we want you to come back and play every day. We want you to come back and engage with your fans on Xbox Live or PlayStation Network. Football is no different. And one of the things certainly at Liverpool we were able to do is recognizing that, you know, you play maybe twice a week for 90 minutes, but your fans are 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, thinking about Liverpool Football Club around the globe in the hundreds of millions of people.
Peter's had an incredible career. From Senior VP of Global Sports Marketing at Reebok, President of Sega of America, Corporate Vice President of Microsoft's Interactive Entertainment Business Division, where he oversaw the Xbox and Xbox 360 consoles. He then became head of EA Sports Game Division, a CEO of Electronic Arts, and then finally CEO of Liverpool Football Club, his dream job as a Liverpool supporter. He filled that role for 3 years. During that time, won the UEFA Champions League, FIFA Club World Cup, and the Premier League with the team. He was also named Premier League CEO of the Year in 2019. Having left Liverpool last year, he was named as an advisor to Wrexham FC, which in the end of November 2020 was taken over by Canadian actor Ryan Reynolds and the American actor Rob McElhenney. It was also announced in Jan 2021 that he was joining the eGames engine maker Unity as an SVP and GM of Sports and Entertainment Management. The main focus of our conversation was to look at polar opposites of leadership: market leaders against challengers, gaming against sports, startups against a heritage brand, and the US tech belt versus Merseyside. So Peter, hi, thanks for coming on across the time zones.
My pleasure, Matt. Yeah, early in the morning here in Santa Barbara, California.
Well, thanks for going with it. We can have a editing a coffee break if you like at any point. So give us a shout if you need to. So I guess I thought we might start. There are hundreds of places I thought about starting, but I thought we might start with a bit of a compare and contrast, if that's okay, from across your career.
Sure.
Because I guess you had senior roles right the way across the sports space, but also the gaming space. And I was really interested in the similarities and the differences that you see between mm-hmm. sort of leading and managing businesses in both those environments. I guess to kick off with, do they feel different to walk into culture? Do they feel different
yeah.
to leading?
Yes and no. Certainly, I think the core tenets of what you have to deal with, when I think of my 20 years in video gaming with Sega, with Xbox, and with EA, is creating entertainment mm-hmm. and engaging your fans, your gamers, your supporters, keeping them suitably entertained when things aren't going well, and engaged when things aren't going well, and in games and in football and sports, you know, there's different barometers of things not going well, but the ups and downs of everything. But I think certainly we used to, at EA, it was gamer first. We used to say everything we need to do is to benefit the gamer. And when I went to Liverpool in 2017, I adopted this edict of fan first. Everything we need to do is with the fans in mind and what adds greater value to their invaluable support. In gaming, without gamers, there is no industry. There is nothing. Your gamers mean everything to you. And, you know, you've seen the banner, football without fans is nothing, and it's the same there. And if you lose sight of that and you focus on what's good maybe for the entity rather than for your stakeholders, the fans or the video gamers. It's a pretty slippery slope downwards here, and they'll turn on you. And I've had examples of that in both industries.
Okay. Well, I guess they're probably also both fairly cyclical, are they? In the sense that, you know, in the gaming space, you're working on a new release, the release comes out, then you have the sell-through period. And from a sports team perspective, you know, you have a season, you're working through the season, you have two games a week, whatever it might be. And you obviously have this fashion season, so you're working in sport apparel. And so in any of those environments, what's the key to getting yourself some time to actually think and get off the treadmill of that sort of cyclical way of working?
Yeah, I mean, it used to be that way. Gaming turned maybe 10 years ago into live services. So they used to be, you're exactly right. You ship FIFA, let's say. FIFA ships. The team would go to the beach for 2 weeks. They'd come back to the studio. They'd start working on the next game. And the game itself was self-contained. With online gaming and the advent of millions of people playing at the same time, games changed as regards the way you interacted with them. And then they became full-on live services, new content every day, every week, new ways to play, all based on we want you to come back and play every day. We want you to come back and engage with your fans on Xbox Live or PlayStation Network. Football is no different. And one of the things certainly at Liverpool we were able to do is recognizing that, you know, you play maybe twice a week for 90 minutes, but your fans are 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, thinking about Liverpool Football Club around the globe in the hundreds of millions of people. So the thing is, you've got to keep them engaged. You've got to keep them informed. You've got to keep them entertained, if you will. And so creating content is the key. If you follow Liverpool in social media, in the news, every day the LFC TV teams, the media teams are at Kirby, the new training center, filming, talking to players, looking for news angles so that fans come back every single morning to find out what's going on at Liverpool. And I think that becomes the key. And so it's a very simple equation of you acquire your fans, you engage your fans, and then they contribute to your growth. It's this inverted funnel. And it's no different in football than it was in gaming. It's about acquisition. Go get them interested, engage them, have them come back every day and engage with you or your product. And then, you know, in gaming, we would call it monetize. Ultimately, you've got to get some money out of people to be able to generate the capital to keep making games. And same in football. And you've got a virtuous cycle in football. The more money you make, the better players you can buy.
And what can football, or indeed any other sport, learn from gaming? You know, if you're slightly further ahead of being 24/7, 365 a year, you know, what are the tips of the trade you can give us from the world of gaming in that regard?
Liverpool was certainly ahead of a lot of teams in the what I've just mentioned, which is engaging their fans. It's a massive global club. And when I joined the club, one of the things that I saw was you have this massive local focus that is Liverpool Football Club. You'll Never Walk Alone, Anfield, Bill Shankly, you know, European Nights Under the Lights, and all of the aura that is Liverpool Football Club. And so you parlay that into playing on that, the shoulders of the legendary players who are still engaged with the club, an Ian Rush, a Kenny Dalglish, a Robbie Fowler, a John Barnes. You engage those players to be part of this narrative of this football club. What you need to do is to make sure that the fans stay with you, winning or losing. And you need to be almost, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're losing or winning, that there's this aura about it that keeps the fans there. And so I coined this phrase, local heart, global pulse, which is what we are as a football club. In gaming, it's the same thing. If you were just dumping your game and then leaving the gamer behind for 6 months, and then you had to come back and re-engage them, you have to reacquire, re-engage. And so in my early days in gaming, pre-internet, you know, it was, here's a cartridge or here's a disc, and we'll see you again in 2 years. Enjoy this. And so as online came about, it allowed you to engage and keep them engaged. So in simple business terms, the cost of acquisition of a new consumer is far more expensive than retaining them. So you spent money and resources to keep them engaged. And like I said, in the old days in gaming, it was all very shrouded. We wouldn't tell you what games were coming, and We wouldn't even give you a screenshot because we didn't want to, quote unquote, give the game away. That quickly moved into, let's talk to you every day about what we're doing. What are some of the technical challenges? Here's some screenshots of what you can expect. And so you got this developer blog going. And by the time the game came out, the gamer felt invested and part of the journey. And so, if you will, the last 3 feet of the sale, which is the reach to take it off the shelf in the old days, was that little bit easier because they were bought in because they've been along on the journey. And I think you can say the same about gaming and about football. Keep them on the journey. There's always next season. You know, in Liverpool's case, it's been a tough year. And, you know, only yesterday, the draw against Real Madrid takes them out of the Champions League. But you watch the reaction of the fans and it's like, we're ready again for next year. So there's no disappointment or I'm fed up with this or whatever. You just have to build that substantive platform of support that is immune to winning and losing.
And I guess that creates a different leadership challenge, does it, to working for an organization that's a clear market leader, as you say, whether that's Liverpool or whether that's EA, or whether that's at the time Reebok, as distinct perhaps from working with a challenger organization like a Wrexham, where you're advising now, where, you know, I'm imagining that the things that cross the CEO's desk, you know, they're not immune to failure yet. You know, they're not immune to the difficult results and challenging times. Right. So I know you're not leading Wrexham, but what do you notice about the different types of challenges crossing the CEO's desk, and how much of the CEO role do you think changes with the size of the organization versus how much is just a constant?
Well, it's a great the latter of your questions is a great question, and let's talk Wrexham, and then I can give you my view on Liverpool, yeah, having been the CEO there for the last three seasons. In Wrexham's case, it's been a supporters trust. I mean, I even though born and bred in Liverpool, I grew up in my teenage years in Wrexham, and at a time when, you know, we could go to the racecourse ground, 15, 16, 17,000 there, second division football, that the addressable market was all of North Wales and pulling, you know, people from the Wirral. And Wrexham was a football club. John Neil, the manager, great players up front, you know, the I'm dating myself, but the Albert Kinseys and the McMillans. And I can see the team now, 40 years ago. 45 years ago, and those were great days, and it was great for the community, and that's the real substance of what this is all about. What I've learned both at Wrexham and Liverpool is how football can raise community spirit, can give the people who live there, who go through tough times, hope. An affinity is something bigger than their life, that may be a challenged life. In Wrexham's case, you've got a town that has gone through tough times because of its industries have started to wane. Mm-hmm. You go back to coal mining and steel, and, you know, it was and has a little bit of an identity crisis, as it always has done, which I was very proud to live in Wrexham. I played for Wrexham Schoolboys. I played for at the racecourse ground. I'm talking the early 70s here, but you know, and we were very proud of our football club, because when you said Wrexham, it's not the town. It was the football club in those days. And, you know, times 100 with Liverpool, you know, you get into Liverpool and you realize, and I certainly realized it, but interesting, my wife, who is one step removed, looked at the impact that the football club had on the emotional well-being of the people at Liverpool, certainly the red half of Liverpool. Mm-hmm. And she volunteered a tremendous amount during our period there to help people with social isolation. I formed my own charitable foundation. I've been lucky in life, and so mm-hmm. I was able to give back to the people that where I was born and what my personality is all about. I'm a Scouser. And shame on me if I don't recognize, by being a Scouser, and certainly when you travel the world, that those traits serve you well. And I've learned that. And so forming the Peter Moore Foundation back in Liverpool to help the people that were going through difficult times, food poverty, this Alder Hey Hospital, a fabulous hospital that is a very important part of the community there. Things like that were important. So football and community go hand in hand. And mm-hmm. particularly what we've just been through with the global pandemic and the challenges with mental health, it was such a God, it was so important that we got Project Restart going in the Premier League and gave people something again. And if, you know, I don't know if you remember, but in the early days, like null and void, and we can't play this anymore. Or we need to go to neutral venues. No game can be played at home. Now we take for granted that we're going to watch this weekend a full Premier League season. It's going to be an exciting end because the battle for the top four is probably, you know, three or four clubs can get that fourth place. And we take for granted, you know, the COVID restrictions. But I will never forget those dark periods being a Premier League CEO, how the Premier League fought its way through some of the challenges in April and May and June to get the game back going again in July. Yes, there were financial implications that if we didn't finish the season, you know, that the broadcasters obviously wanted, you know, rebates, which in, to a certain extent they got. But I also think it lifted the spirits of the nation. It gave you something to watch on weekends and your affinity again. And now, like I say, we take it for granted there's a full Premier League schedule, but it was not easy to get going. So what I think is, you know, the importance that football plays in community spirit, particularly in a community that is down. And it's one of the reasons that Rob and Ryan bought Wrexham, you know, because they realized that football is a great platform to do good. And it's as much a community play as it is any kind of other play.
And it sounds as an outsider looking into that, that there's some time and effort and investment going into the community at the same time that obviously there's the much publicized Amazon documentary and things going on as well. Yep. So it from an outsider looking in, it looks like there's sort of some investment in the local heart and the global pulse at the same time, if you like, to use your sort of Liverpool strapline. Is that fair? Are you trying to do both concurrently?
Yes, I think, but the primary reason for Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney to buy Wrexham Football Club is to help a community, any community, but their need in a much bigger way than when I arrived at Liverpool. I realized that I could spend some of my money to help people that had given me such a head start in life by being born there.
Yeah.
That they realized, and the story that Rob would tell you is that in the early weeks of lockdown, he stumbled across a documentary called Sunderland Till I Die. And he turns that on. And Rob is a big sports fan. He's a Philadelphia guy. And he turns that on and is immediately hooked, not by watching the football, and I'm sure you've seen the documentary, but not by watching the football, but the reaction of the fans in the pub and the reaction of what it meant to them. Sunderland, as you and I know, is a massive football club that has underperformed and has not served its community well as a result. And in a community like Sunderland, shipbuilding, that again, very similar to Wrexham, if you will, is that gone through tough times, industry's moved on, maybe the city hasn't kept up with what it needs to do. And you know, Rob will tell you, calls Ryan and said, we need to buy a football club. And Ryan goes, okay, but why? He said, because it is a conduit, it's a platform for doing good. So Rob watched the documentary, said, I know these people. And he explained this to me. And I said, well, they're from Sunderland, they're from northeast of England. He said, no, this is Philadelphia. This is every city that has been let down by its sports teams. This is every city that's gone through tough times. So what you're seeing here is, I think, philanthropic ownership. Ownership of a football club, not to make money, definitely to provide results on the pitch, but to provide those results on the pitch so it lifts the spirit of the community. And it's as simple as that.
And so when you see someone like Aviation Gin getting involved in and doing things with the club, is that as much about trying to realize their own social objectives through an organization that's heart beats in the same way, or is that actually about more about the global ambition piece, or is it a bit of both, or is it how are Wrexham thinking about brand relationships and commercial relationships that stay credible to what they're trying to achieve locally?
You've got to raise the profile of the football club to bring in the equivalent of football's virtuous cycle.
Yeah.
The virtuous cycle of football is pretty simple. You play well on the pitch, you start winning games, sponsors are attracted to you. You get promoted or you win cups. Sponsors then want to be a part of that because they realize, you know, they'll get attention as a result. you get more money, you buy better players. Better players win you more games. Winning more games brings you better sponsors. And so in Ryan's case with Aviation Gin, this is not about selling more gin. This is about raising the profile of Wrexham Association Football Club to be more global in its reach. The quality of sponsors, you know, you look at a football club and you can get a pretty good indication what's on their shirts, what's on the billboards around the hoardings around the pitch. The other thing that they did is went and bought LED systems, which for Vanarama National League team is a big jump.
Absolutely.
You know, but said, look, if we're going to prepare this football club for a better future with better commercial opportunities, and one of the better ways to do that is put LED around the pitch, which certainly from televised games it looks cleaner. They had some fun with it. You know, if you saw the first game, they said, we're watching you. There was Ryan and Rob speaking. So in both of them, very irreverent, a comedic link that is very dry and irreverent. And they're imparting that in the way that they're taking on their roles as stewards of this football club. And that's what they see themselves as, stewards.
So I wondered actually whether that advertising or the LED boards had your fingerprints on a little bit, in the sense that I remember EA were one of the first innovators around how you can use brand integration and LEDs in more creative ways in a gaming space. So I wonder whether you've been a little bit involved in that, but you don't have to tell me.
Well, we certainly, the core group that are there, there's four or five of us that are kind of the brains trust, and I'm 5,500 miles away. Is that we saw an opportunity to buy a set of LEDs that were available, and we said, absolutely. And Ryan and Rob jumped straight in and said, we do this. It's an investment for the future. There have been a core group of sponsors that have been very loyal to Wrexham, but they're from Wrexham, and which is great, but they're Wrexham companies, and there's still a place for those people because they've stuck through the club through thick and thin. But you need to upgrade ultimately and start bringing in sponsors that can give you what's known as activation programs that will start to bring the club maybe to the United States here and maybe have this better aura in advance of results on the pitch that attracts bigger sponsors. And that would be the way that an LED can certainly do that.
Very good. So I wondered if we might broaden the conversation out a little bit from Wrexham, just to look at the role of a chief executive in growing the value of any club. Because there's been a lot of chatter in the sports marketing industry in the UK, at least over the last couple of weeks, around the sort of PE numbers that the Manchester United or someone like that might operate in, as distinct to other brands with global profile and global digital audiences, albeit first party audiences and a TikTok and someone like that. And I guess, the hard reality is they're not the same kind of businesses. And one knows its audience in the billions, and one might know its audience in the single figure or double figure millions. What's your take on, for any investor looking at football, where does the value lie? I'm not talking about Wrexham, to be crystal clear. I'm looking more broadly. Where does the value lie?
Yeah, I think when you think about people who do invest in a football club, there seems to be a number of objectives in their mind. First of all, there's the emotional value. You very rarely just see people from, let's say, Wall Street or the City just say, hey, this is a great financial investment and this is a better place to put my money than in equities or mutual funds or whatever. There's always an emotional. You want to be involved in that football club for personal reasons, for reasons of, as I just said, with Rob and Ryan, for maybe doing good. And you do see that with many ownership groups. And I think a lot of them have maybe ultimately a long-term exit strategy where they recognize that football continues to grow, the media rights continue to grow, that if you can get the recipe right, this virtuous cycle right, that your investment will continue to grow. And then ultimately, should you wish, there is an exit strategy of selling the club to somebody that wants to take on the next level. I think that if there's the old adage, you want to make some money in football is start off with a lot of money in football and then, you know, see where you come out. Other than selling at the right time, you know, it's not a great investment, but I think it's an emotional investment. I think many, and certainly the ownership group that I work for, Fenway Sports Group in Boston, saw this as a phenomenal opportunity to make a difference in Liverpool, to add to their portfolio of properties, including the Boston Red Sox and New England Sports Network and Roush Fenway Racing. And these are emotional owners. They are emotionally attached to this football club. You know, whilst their investment, I think, ultimately has proven to be incredibly valuable, when you look at the perceived value of the club today versus what they paid for it, they're also equally proud to have that sixth Champions League trophy, to be the stewards of the club when our first Premier League trophy arrives at Anfield, and all of that. And I've seen that firsthand, you know, how proud they are of what they've been able to achieve. But ultimately, you know, they're in an investment group, and you know, they'll continue to invest in the infrastructure of the stadium, invest in the infrastructure, you know, a £50 million brand new training center. Just at Anfield Road will eventually get redeveloped. So Anfield has a 61,000 capacity. And all of this is reinvesting profits, if you will, if there are any, back into the club to make the football club more accessible to fans, because getting a ticket to Anfield is a challenge on any given day. And creating a global property. Liverpool was and always will be a global property, but to have something that fits well into their portfolio is something I know they're very proud. And I can't speak for other ownership groups. There are different types where actually, you know, the club is a publicly traded entity. There are you know, groups come in internationally, you know, to make an impact in the UK, maybe for different reasons. But certainly my experience in working for Fenway Sports Group is that they made an investment. They saw an opportunity in a football club that was a distressed value at that time and in real trouble, and not too far away from administration, which many people forget, and acquired the club, invested patient capital, have never taken a penny out of the club. And I'm very familiar and very aware of that. And instead have continued to invest in their investment. And, you know, who knows years from now what that leads to for them. But right now, this is a group that's proud of what they've built. No intention that I'm aware of selling, per se. Very involved in the day-to-day operations of the football club. And, you know, we'll go through the thick and thin, and did a brilliant job in acquiring Jurgen Klopp to come in painting a picture of what that football club should look like and the resources he was going to have to get after success. And they provided him with those resources. And of course, as a brilliant manager he is, he made best use of those. And, you know, at one point, I don't know, 12 months ago, we were champions of everything and everywhere. You know, as in football, we've a little bit of a rougher ride this time, but it's still Liverpool Football Club.
And the way you talk there, you know, you unsurprisingly, the interplay between the P&L and the balance sheets, long-term investments, short-term priorities, you know, you can hear them just playing out very naturally in the way in which you talk. But I think what we've seen in the UK more broadly, maybe not at that top echelon, is I know I've had conversations with a lot of senior leaders dealing with stressed assets right now and having to, frankly, learn how to manage and manipulate a balance sheet for the first time, because they were sort of riding a wave of inexorable growth and didn't really have to worry. You know, what if none of the organizations you've been leading have necessarily been in that place, but what intuitively would you see were the key things if for somebody listening who is on top of a distressed asset right now, what does the path back look like?
You've got to have a long-term, when I say long-term, 3 to 5 year strategy and stick with it. And you're right, I have not been through a distressed asset, but I can tell you that at EA in some dark years in 2011, 12-ish, if you go look back at the performance of the company then, stock price was below $12. Now the stock today is $140. And why is that? Because we were going through this massive change in the video game business, which was moving away from buying discs, from buying physical media at retail stores, and changing into a direct-to-consumer network business by which you would get your 30 or 40 gigabyte game delivered directly to your hard drive. EA had to use its balance sheet during that period, and I was the chief operating officer at that time, to basically say for the next 2 years, every penny we make, we're going to invest in infrastructure. We're going to start walking away from our customer who's Walmart or Best Buy or Virgin Media there in the UK or Game. And yes, we'll still sell them whatever discs they want, but the customer is going to be the gamer. And the long-term strategy, as difficult as it was to get there, eventually paid off, which is better operating margins. Certainly, you know, not having to worry about marking down, you know, millions of discs that weren't selling, and changing the company and changing the people and the type of people that work for the company. A lot of people had to leave the company and go find other things to do because they either disagreed with the direction or weren't suited with their skill sets to go to the next level, which is to be a network company that happened to deliver video games as its product. And I think I can still see meetings that we had that laid out this strategy, and the CEO, you know, saying, look, this may not be for you, and this is going to be difficult. And if you need to leave right now, then maybe you're better off somewhere else and you'll have a great career. But this is what we're going to do. It's going to be choppy waters. At the end, it's going to be great, but you've got to believe in me. And it took 4 years to do that.
Get the very best of Sports Pro sent straight to your inbox. Head to sportspromedia.com and sign up for the Sports Pro Daily. You'll get a roundup of all the biggest stories, features, and opinion from our team every single morning. You'll find that all and much more at sportspromedia.com. Sports Pro, connecting and inspiring the business world of sport.
Let's maybe move on to talent, if that's okay. And I guess I'm interested in, firstly, the dynamics between how talent interacts with your revenues in both a club and a gaming environment. So football has this unhealthy ability. It would seem to me that an extra pound coming into the organisation, 70 pence of it, tends to make its way out to players one way or another. But what's the dynamics in gaming? So I guess the marginal profit on, especially on digitally delivered game, is really high, isn't it? Because your developer creates the product,
If you're delivering direct to digital, you can be expecting gross operating margins 70 to 75%, any business would be very happy with, because you're not dealing with physical media, you're not shipping anything, you're not making anything. And you're not having to price protect anything that doesn't sell. It's on demand. Talent is critical in both instances. And yes, it's plain for everybody to see, you know, the cost of getting talent with agents' fees in football. And then, you know, players' wages every year, you see them, and they're a massive percentage of the football club's income. Little different in gaming, but there are massive incentives for game developers to create a successful game. Many gaming companies are publicly traded, so equity awards are given as part of the compensation, and you want to protect your talent. And in a thing, in an industry like gaming, where there's only so much talent, very similar to, say, the Premier League, there's only so many great players in the world that can play in the Premier League, you've got to retain your talent. And it can be challenging in both industries, and I've seen both sides of it, where the equivalent of your star striker is your executive producer on a top studio that's creating games that can generate $500 million to $1 billion. And so you have to take care of those people. Same in football as in gaming. They can be interesting individuals to negotiate with because they recognize their value. But you know, you can be extremely wealthy in gaming if you're leading or at some level of management at a very successful studio, based on bonuses, based on you don't get royalties per se because you're part of a company, but performance bonuses, as they are in football, same in video games. It can be in your contract. You deliver this game, it sells this many units, or it delivers this much revenue, you're going to get this. And so developers are driven to that, the same way that strikers can be selfish because they want their goal bonus. It's not too dissimilar there.
And have you found in your time leading businesses, whether you're talking about a sponsored athlete at Reebok, or you're talking about those relationships at EA, or your time at Liverpool, or maybe even the new striker that's going to get Wrexham back up into the higher echelons of football, have you found yourself less involved in those conversations as time moved on, or actually as players and talent becomes more aware of their worth, you find yourself getting more involved now maybe than 10, 15 years ago when we were in a lot more hierarchical world?
Yeah, certainly at Liverpool, I had nothing to do with that. And it was very clear. Our structure at Liverpool, I was responsible for the business of football, that stadium operations, for everything that made football happen until the whistle went. And then that's Jürgen's job. And so I had nothing. And we had a sporting director. We had the manager in Jürgen Klopp and myself that was running the business of football alongside the chief commercial officer, Billy Hogan, who's now the CEO of the football club. And we were very clear in our lanes of what we needed to do. And in particular, I think the advent, if you will, somewhat of an American a structure of that sporting director who is responsible for transfers in and out, loans, and the general well-being of the squad financially, if you will, is a very specialist role. And so you're seeing more and more clubs do that because, trust me, if you're the CEO of the football club, you've got a lot on your plate. To be able to do both what you need to do to manage your fan base, to manage, in my case, 800 people who didn't kick a football for Liverpool Football Club, but manage full-time employees, extra 2,000 on game day that came in to make that stadium work and to deliver value to our fans and keep them safe. This is what I believed, and it was very clear to me from the day one I got that this was the right structure. Let me focus on football. Jürgen, you go figure out how to win games. Michael Edwards, the sporting director, you go identify talent, make sure that we're moving talent out as talent comes in and getting that squad right in conjunction with Jürgen Klopp. And Billy Hogan and I in particular work very closely together on building the commercial profile of the football club. Mm-hmm. My chief operating officer, Andy Hughes, we work very closely on building what is the Anfield experience, and making sure that we were delivering a holistic football experience, not just great football on the pitch, but when I came in, we restructured how the internal football club was built, was operated, and really, quite frankly, invested a lot of our balance sheet in new technologies to reach out to our global fan base, e-commerce, mobile, database management, all of that, so that we could maximize the value we could give to people like me. Here I am, and I'm going to watch Leeds United, Liverpool on Monday, and it'll be lunchtime here in California, but I'll put my Liverpool shirt on and, depending on what I feel like, maybe go to the local pub because they're all open again now and watch the game like I am, which is a fan. And now Billy Hogan has to appeal to me, as a Liverpool fan in California. And, so from that perspective, it's a very interesting dynamic, and it's the modernization of a football organization. Some clubs still, the CEO wants to be directly involved in the transfer business. And what they have to do then is put a substructure underneath them that focuses on the business per se. To me, I think the way that we were and are structured at Liverpool Football Club is the structure of the future. It does have American roots of the general manager who works with the head coach, if you will, to make sure the team is right. But there's a lot of work involved in modern football in managing players, managing the finances of those players, the transfer system, the loan system. And for a CEO to get involved in that, I don't believe is a great use of their time.
Okay. Well, listen, as we start to draw to a close, this could be a spectacular disaster, this next piece, but I thought I'd give it a try.
Okay.
I'm quite, or my son in particular is quite a fan of the Ultimate Team concept that sits on that seats on FIFA, when you can kind of build something from around the world and look for the talent that. So if you think about across gaming and sports, any geography, any function, and you thought about building a sort of an ultimate team for a football club for the next sort of 10 years, and you could hire HR people from here, finance people from here, get investment from there, like what would it look like? I gave you a blank sheet of paper. What, building on where you started, where would you take that, the old structure of your ultimate team?
Yeah, my ultimate team, I'd like to think at Liverpool that I left, we were very close to having our ultimate team. It was a nice balance of people that had been there for a few years, that you know, general counsel, head of communications, chief operating officer. And we were in a separate location than the football team itself. I mean, miles apart. We were in Liverpool City Centre. They are in Liverpool City Centre. And we operated, I don't want to say as a separate entity, but our job 24 hours a day was focused on managing all of the challenges of being Liverpool Football Club. And I say that, you know, a fan base that is voracious in its appetite for Liverpool, working with the police, working with local authorities, working to build stadium environments that, you know, if you've been to Anfield recently versus going to Anfield 10 years ago, it's a completely different experience. And what we wanted to do, and again, I was very focused on this, is create, I don't want to say an American-style stadium environment, but certainly have people come to Anfield 4 hours before kickoff and go see the Shankly statue, go see the new Bob Paisley, Emlyn Hughes statue, go pay their respects at the Hillsborough Memorial, go walk down 96th Avenue where there are thousands of stones that commemorate fans, my dad included, that are laid there right outside of the new main stand. Go to the store, go buy some merchandise, go to the local pubs, go across the street to Home Baked, a community pie shop that serves the people in one of the most impoverished postcodes in England, Anfield, and so L4. And that was working for us. And what I would do, Matt, is I would get to the game a good 3 hours before kickoff and simply walk around and talk to the fans. And as I was there longer, people recognized me, and I would hear, it was delightful to hear so many foreign languages and look at the look on people's faces when they walked up Walton Breck Road and they finally saw the Kop and they finally saw Anfield, and create this environment that you're not just there for 90 minutes, that you're not just there to see Liverpool win. Yeah. You know, I always, as I traveled the world, I always used to spend a night with the official Liverpool supporters club, wherever I was in the world, Dubai, Cape Town, Bangkok, and go give them a strategy presentation because they're the fans. Mm-hmm. I did this in 16 cities, either if I was on vacation or I was traveling with the team, Munich, Madrid, you know, I can, Shanghai, you rattle them all off because they need to hear from the CEO. I'm in town. I would rather than go to some business dinner, I'd rather go to the local pub, which I did, and put up a screen and present for 45 minutes and then take questions, because you have an obligation to your customers, you know, who are your fans. And so I would like to think that we, as that ultimate team at Liverpool, built a stadium experience that, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. We stand on Bill Shankly's shoulders. We stand on Kevin Keegan, Tommy Smith, Ian Callaghan, Ian St. John, all the way into Kenny Dalglish and Ian Rush and Steve McManaman and Robbie Fowler. We stand on their shoulders. And being able to create that experience for fans who, in some instances, Matt, you know, it's their once-in-a-lifetime visit. And the interesting thing I always found is people say, they didn't say, I want to come and watch Liverpool play. They always said, I want to go to Anfield.
Yeah.
And no disrespect to other football clubs, you don't hear that about other football clubs. They want to come to Anfield. I commissioned an environmental impact report in my first year at Liverpool, my second year, with Deloitte. And because it was very clear to me living there, living right downtown in Liverpool at first, that we have a massive impact on that city's finances. And I would ask the question of my team, how much do you think? And they go, a lot. I said, well, I come from Silicon Valley. A lot is not a great answer. Yeah, a lot is not a great answer. We did this this report, And we realized, well, Deloitte told us that £494 million each year came into the city through the gross value add of Liverpool Football Club. Try to get a hotel room when Liverpool are playing at home. Try to get a restaurant reservation. The city's airport, the CEO of the airport became a good friend of mine. You know, those charter flights were coming in from all over the world into Liverpool, and the city was alive on game day. And so when I think about my ultimate team, I'd like to think that I had it there. I think it's more about the structure of your ultimate team and the players within that team knowing their roles, which they did and still do, and created an entity in Liverpool Football Club that, regardless of whether we win or lose, will continue to grow, will be loved worldwide. And you know, I can walk down the streets here in Santa Barbara, that I've done several times, and people recognize me. And, you know, they talk about Liverpool. I mean, in the middle of Santa Barbara, California. And I'll stand there and talk as long, you know, I now talk as a fan, as long as they like to listen to me about our love of this football club.
Fantastic. And what do you imagine the chief executive role of Liverpool Football Club will look like in 10 years' time? Will it be different? So are there skills or traits that are going to be more important?
I certainly think it may move, because of the magnitude of what money means to football, it may move towards being more of a investment banker type, if you will. And I don't know. Billy is a fabulous choice to succeed me. He's been with Fenway Sports Group for, I believe, 10, 12 years now. He came over and committed, he and his family, to living in England to take on the role of chief commercial officer. And, you know, but there'll be a replacement for Billy down the line as well. So it may well be, depending on what ownership think is required of the role, a little bit more money oriented. I'd like to think it will be still focused on the fans. And the one thing, as I left Liverpool, the one comment that was made as I was getting ready to move back from a number of people was, you made the club and the fans feel closer together. And if that's my legacy, and that's the legacy, I think, of any CEO, I'm happy with that.
Very good. And I guess maybe the final regular question then would be, so as you made that move back to America, sort of a year or so ago, maybe slightly longer, and I know I made a similar move a year or so ago. What have you learned about moving on, about sort of compartmentalizing that journey and saying, I'm desperately proud of that, but now, because a lot of our industry are moving on from roles now, for good or for bad.
Yeah. I only left Liverpool in December, and I left the role in September of last year, so it's still fresh with me. But I think you look back, you always look back. Mm-hmm. This was the job of a lifetime for me. I was born in Liverpool. My dad took me to Anfield in 1959 for the first time. We beat Leighton Orient 4-3. My dad has "You'll Never Walk Alone" on his tombstone. And for me to be able to take my experience of what I had learned in my primarily American life and bring that back, and not only at a professional level to help the football club be better off the pitch, but also to be present and use some of the money I've been fortunate to make to help people's lives be a little bit better, whether it was social isolation, whether it's food poverty, whether it's education, whether it's supporting a magnificent children's hospital in Alderhay. I couldn't do that from afar. I couldn't do that just going back to Liverpool, but in the profile of my role as CEO gave me the ability to give back in ways that I never could have done. And I often speak about that now. I did a TED talk on a similar theme of you know, being from Liverpool and what that means. And for people that, you know, as I did when I first arrived in America, it was not easy as an immigrant. And I went through some tough times. And you look in the mirror and you say, what do you got? And, well, I'm a Scouser. And, you know, that I've got the gift of the gab. I've got maybe an ill-founded sense of self-confidence, like all as Liverpudlians have. And I've got this sense of I can do it, which Scousers have in abundance. And that got me through. And that's got me to where I am today. And that's given me so many great experiences over my life. And I think it was important when I got back to Liverpool to give back, because I recognized without being a Liverpoolian, I wouldn't be there.
It seems to me you yourself have a local heart and a global pulse.
Absolutely. Born in Sefton General Hospital in 1955. And my nickname when we moved to Wrexham was Scouse, because nobody had ever met anybody from Liverpool. It was a, it was a long time ago, in the mid-60s, and still to this day. And when I went to physical education college, I still had a broad Liverpool accent. Still to this day, people who know me from those days through and then contact me in social media call me Scouse. And I haven't, you know, that kind of, when I went to America, oh, yeah, that slipped away. So it's been 40 odd years since I've been called Scouse, but people still pop up and call me Scouse. And that was my nickname. And I couldn't be more proud of being from Liverpool.
Okay, you can still hear it in the way you say Shankly, by the way. Listen, we know, so to close out, what we normally do is ask, we normally ask people for their kind of key message from everything they've shared in 10 words or less. I struggle to think you better local heart, global pulse, but you're very welcome to have a go if you fancy.
I love local heart, global pulse. For me, you know, and I used "with hope in your heart" as the tagline for my foundation. And, you know, the words of "you'll never walk alone," you can take any verse from there. But "with hope in your heart" is what I decided was something I've always had. And it to me embodies what Liverpoolians, when you think of the history of that city and what they've been through with the ups and downs and everything. And I think it's, you know, poignant. We're talking today. This is the 32nd anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster on April 15th. We've always had hope in your heart. And you know, a plug for the 96, if you will, that will be never forgotten. Football changed irrevocably on that particular day. And today is 32 years since we lost 96 people who went to a football game and never came back again. So "with hope in your heart," local heart, global pulse.
Fantastic. Well, all the very best with Wrexham and pulling us back to our local hearts a little bit in that area of community. And it's been a complete privilege. So thanks ever so much for taking the time.
My pleasure, Matt. Thank you.
The Playbook podcast is published by SportsPro and is part of a wider series delivering agenda-free, pragmatic advice on how to navigate your organisation through change. To explore the library and find out about the Playbook Lab's residential executive training programme, head to sportspromedia.com/playbook.